Commissioner, unless you have others you'd like to have join you. We have in front of us a couple of things. As part of the governor's budget presentation, we have, I don't know if it's the slide presentation, kind of the broad strokes of the budget. And then we have some particular details of things that I guess I'll suggest the governor wanted to highlight where he put together some further explanation of some of what's in the budget. So, Commissioner and Mr. Showalter, however you'd like to proceed, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Hansen. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Management and Budget Department, formerly known as Finance, and with me is our State Budget Director, Jim Showalter. We have provided a slide presentation that we will be working through and, of course, available at all times for whatever questions, which I'm assuming you will have.
Commissioner, when you called me, whenever it was, and mentioned the change of the department's name, you know, we agreed it probably wasn't, I mean, it was an appropriate change. Now I guess I should ask how much it cost to change the
letter. Well, that's a good question, Mr. Chairman. If you go back to the December 4th forecast, you will notice that we actually used the cheesy stickouts to cover up the old logo with the new one. So we have diligently used every, and I'm still using old stationery.
You just kind of cross it out, and
we're frugal.
Good.
So if you look at the first slide, a lot has changed in 2 years. We all remember to the days back to 2007 where the biennial budget had $34.6 billion that we approved. At that time, the economy was growing at a 2.1%, which in comparison to earlier years, particularly those of you that were here in the 90s, that seemed rather mild. 2,771,400 Minnesotans had jobs, and the federal deficit was $161 billion, or 1.2% of our GDP. But if you look at the next slide, we're now preparing a budget based on revenues of $31.9 billion. That's a significant reduction in revenues from one biennium to the next. Probably for most of us here, and some of us have been here longer than others, this is one of the bigger changes you will ever see from one biennium to the next in a reduction in revenue. A economy that is now shrinking, according to our forecast, at 2.5%, and most likely when we update our February forecast, that will show an even greater number. That's quite a significant difference from the beginning of this biennium. And fewer Minnesotans have jobs, 2,720,400. That's 51,000 less. And again, I'm sure there's going to be more as we go on in the year. And then the federal deficit is $1.2 trillion, or 8.3% of the gross domestic product. That seems pretty high to me. So it's a changing context that we are preparing a budget this 2 year biennium from the what we experienced 2 years ago. And that's the context to keep in mind as you understand our budget and prepare your own. And that's the context we had when we prepared ours. The governor's budget principles are on the next page. First and foremost, we're constitutionally required to submit a balanced budget. And second, the governor has said, second principle, fund priorities in order of importance. Third, even though we're balancing the budget, we have to strategically position Minnesota for success in a changing world. Fourth, enhance and expand pay for performance. And fifth, don't increase burdens by raising taxes. As we put our budget together, we kept on the next slide, the following important financial management goals, Mr. Chairman. We have a recommendation for $250 million in budget reserves to address and cushion against any additional economic risk. We maintained the $350 million cash flow account. It is a, I think, a testament to the strong bipartisan support we have in the state for good financial management. This fall, when other states were, when the credit markets seized up in September and October, when other states were like California and eastern states and some of the southern states were looking for ways to short-term cash flow their state budget, we were fine because we had the $350 million in our cash flow account. We also, as a financial management tool in this budget, we understated the potential level of the federal fiscal assistance. You will see in our budget it's just over $900 million, and all of the estimates we're receiving, as well as you are receiving, are going to be a lot higher. The issue, and we'll get Jim will talk a little bit more about the stimulus here in a minute, but the issue will be how it interacts with our proposals and which of the governor's proposals we'll have to back off of in order to meet the maintenance of effort requirements of the federal government. And also, we improved by about half the structural deficit in 2012 and 2013. So the next slide, what's the bottom line? If you compare biennium to biennium, it's a 34.89. We're due to spend about 34.36. In 10 and 11, it's a 33.61. It amounts to a 2.2% decline, Mr. Chairman, or $750 million. As I talk further, you will see that it is a difficult story to tell, and depending on your comparison, in this we compared biennium to biennium, but in further slides I will show compare it to the December forecast, and also when you factor in the shift. As those of you remember what we did the last time, it makes comparisons a little different. So we'll get into the different pictures of this in a moment. But on the next slide, what did we do? Governor's solution. Remember, the December forecast was a $4.847 billion deficit. Our spending cuts and savings portion, $2.5 billion. And each of these lines will have a slide following that drills down into more detail. So the spending, that's mostly spending cuts, and the savings reflects mostly the healthcare access fund being merged into the general fund, and we then assume the balance of that in the general fund. Other resources is a category that includes the K-12 shift, the federal stimulus. Well, we'll see it in a minute. Okay, and then the tax cuts, initiatives, and reserves reflects the net total of the governor's tax proposals. The initiatives are primarily K-12 and a few other odds and ends, and then the budget reserve at $250 million. Those add up to $48.58 with an $11 million balance on the bottom line. On the next page, you see the budget, the spending cut savings category. The spending cuts actually add up to $2.3 billion. We have a slide later on that breaks this down further in relation to human services and local aid, so you'll see it drill down even more. And then the healthcare access fund that I just mentioned and other savings, $153 million. On other resources, the federal stimulus is we're booking $920 million. It is likely to be much more, but how it interacts in the maintenance of effort is an issue. And also the other issue that I should have mentioned and clarified at the beginning that overlays our entire budget is that we have another forecast, as you know, on at the end of February, and we are anticipating another downturn in both 8 and 9 as well as 10 and 11. The K-12 shift at almost 1.3, and then the appropriation bonds at $983 million.
Senator Frederickson.
Chairman, Commissioner, do you want us to ask questions now for clarification or wait until you're all through the package?
Senator, I guess I was hoping we could let the Commissioner get through the presentation.
I'll hold my question then.
Okay. then the on the next slide, the budget solution, tax cuts, initiatives in reserve, you see that the governor's recommended new spending initiatives total $323 million. It's primarily his K-12 package of initiatives. The tax cuts reflects the net of the governor's tax reduction and other areas in that. And then the budget reserve is $250 million for a $860 million number. So the governor, in the next slide, the governor's top budget priorities. First and foremost, we need to get Minnesotans back to work and create jobs. It's enhance Minnesota's job climate. We need to make ourselves more competitive and increasingly competitive in the world market, improve K-12 education. We need to protect state public safety programs, maintain military and veterans programs, and increase government reform and accountability. The first area of emphasis is the governor outlined in his State of the State address, the Minnesota Jobs Recovery Act, designed to create jobs and improve Minnesota's business climate. The first proposal is to reduce Minnesota's high corporate tax rate from over a six-year period from 9.8% phased in through, 2015 to 4.8%. An upfront capital equipment sales tax exemption, a reinvestment tax credit, a one-year deduction for equipment purchases, and an angel and early-stage capital tax credits, and a 50% capital gains exemption, all designed to provide incentives to large and small business alike to create job growth. And transforming K-12 education on the next slide, the governor increases K-12 funding even in a time with a budget crisis. We transform the K-12 education funding system by linking all future funding increases to improved performance. And we require all districts and charter schools to use the QCOMP performance pay system. Currently, if you look on the next slide, 44 school districts and 26 charter schools currently participate in the QCOMP professional development and achievement-based pay program. For districts not currently in QCOMP, we authorize a per-payment funding increase of $300 per pupil, an amount comparable to 5% increase in the general education funding formula. For those school districts that are currently participating, they get $260 per pupil, and this will increase it to $300 per pupil. And on the next page, the governor's Pay for Progress initiative will link K-12 funding increases directly to student achievement. With school districts and charter schools will receive up to an additional 2% per student on the general education formula for students meeting standards or showing reasonable progress towards achievement. On the next page, we provide pictorially the pie chart showing our areas of spending. You will see that about 85% of our budget is health and human services, the education clusters, and local aids and credits. And the rest of it, while important, anything you do in those big areas obviously influences the rest of it. And you will see, and as we all know, the human services area continues to rise, and that influences the decisions we make in all of the other areas. And then on the next slide, just to remind you, Mr. Chairman and members, that our budget is an all-funds budget and that it totals $57.6 billion. We obviously have most of the flexibility in the general fund, and that's where our deficit is. You see the amount of federal funds that we receive. That'll probably go up. The trunk highway fund and all of the rest. Now, the next two slides, we get into the differing, depending on your perspective or which set of numbers you look at. The next two, we try to show you the picture by spending area. On the slide titled fiscal year 8 and 9 versus proposed 10 and 11, you see that we increased K-12 spending by 1.9%, and higher ed is reduced, and health and human services is actually increased by 9.6%. Now, this is compared to actual 8 and 9 spending, not what the forecast, not what we forecasted on December 4th. So if you turn to the next page, and actually you hold your slide presentation so you can kind of look at both, you look down to Health and Human Services. Now you compare the governor's proposed 10 and 11 budget to the forecast, and you look at the Health and Human Services number, and compared to what was forecasted on December 4th, it's an actual 10.3% decline. And the forecast, as you all know, serving on this committee, picked up about a 20 or more percent increase in K-12 spending. So what we are actually doing with the governor's proposal is decreasing the increase. And I think we've seen that before. But overall, human services spending in the governor's budget is increasing by 9.6%, but not as much as what was forecasted in the December 4th budget. And then you see K-12 education is still at 1.1%. The other anomaly on here, the debt service is picked up by the appropriation bonds, and that's why it shows as a reduction of 89% and 87% on the other chart. So on the next selected reductions, to take our, remember, back to that $2.3 billion number, Mr. Chairman, this breaks it out in 10 and 11 as well as in the tails. You will see the county aids at 126 carried out to 131, local aids, and then the U of M and Minsky. And then on the next slide, the plan substantially reduces the 2012 and 13 gap. If nothing is done, it's 4.6. With the governor's proposal, it's reduced to $2.5 billion. On the next set of slides, it's the health and human services cluster of issues. The governor's budget preserves coverage for children. No children who currently get coverage are cut off of coverage. We also make various reforms that give us better value with what we are spending. We tie chemical dependency spending to performance to try and get a handle on the explosion of costs in that area. We secure a better placement process for vulnerable children through the North Star Care for Children program. And we strengthen provider standards and controls and authorization in the personal care attendant services, and addressing the issues outlined in the legislative auditor's report on PCA, on the PCA program that was issued a few weeks ago. We also, on the next page, reduce provider payments to and specifically to hospitals and to long-term care providers, a rateable reduction of 3%, although nursing homes are held at zero. But we do eliminate the rebasing that I think we put into statute in 07. We consolidate, we merge the healthcare access fund into the general fund in an attempt to get at the dilemma we have where we're expanding program eligibility in a separate off general fund account in the healthcare access account, but we're actually having difficulty paying for the eligibility we have in the general fund. We reduce eligibility for parents and medical assistants to 100% of the federal poverty level, and we maintain a limited state safety net program for single adults. And then on the next page, Mr. Chairman and members, you see the selected health care reductions by category and in the current biennium, as well as through the 2012-13 biennium. The governor's proposal also includes county services reform, and it is our goal to incent counties to consolidate services. We have 87 counties all designed in an era when horse and buggy were prominent. We consolidate and provide incentives in our budget to consolidate administered programs to 15 regional systems designed much like the Lincoln, Lyon, Murray counties in Senator Vickerman's area. They've had a couple of decades of collaboration amongst the three counties and serve as an example to the rest of the state in efficiency in delivering these programs. We designed to save money and improve efficiencies. On the next page, the governor's budget includes about $40 million to upgrade important systems and state government systems that are needed and, if not paid for now, will cost a lot more down the road. The first, expanding the number of licenses available online. These are professional licenses, Mr. Chairman, for plumbers and everyone else who receives a professional license from the state. The cost of that system will be paid for by over a period of years by a fee on the licenses themselves. There's a proposal to strengthen and improve the state data centers. Right now, our data centers are spread out over a lot of different agencies. And it was, I think, a year ago, not this summer, but the summer before, that at the Department of Public Safety, their data center was in the basement, and it was one of those big rains. And but for some brave soul who had a squeegee and pushed the water away, we would have lost some valuable equipment. So what we're proposing is to merge our data centers into one in an enterprise approach and run by the Office of Enterprise Technology. We are proposing to the next phase of the integrated tax system designed to modernize and make our collections of taxes more efficient. And we are proposing to replace our accounting and procurement system that was built in 1994 based on late 1980s technology. It has now reaching and getting towards the end of its useful life. We have, Mr. Chairman, method of paying for this where it's called lease purchase. You will hear more about it this session, but it's designed to marry up the benefits of a system with the costs over a period of time. And on the next slide, we have a minimal fee increases in the general fund. I think it's just around, I think it's $2 million and about $30 million in other funds. And then the tobacco appropriation bonds or appropriation bonds creates almost $1 billion in one-time funds to soften the revenue shortfall. It equals about 50% of our tobacco payments, and it provides one-time funding for non-operating obligations. We started this idea, Mr. Chairman, it started as a tobacco securitization idea on our part, examining what other states were doing. And as we looked at it and looked at the market and saw that the securitization, the stream of tobacco money, so we're not selling in the market, we looked to this idea of appropriation bonds. And what this is we're selling bonds, and we're using payment of it won't be specifically referenced in statute, but it'll be general fund to pay back the bonds over a period of 20 years. It is not an ideal solution in tough times, but it cushions us against further budget cuts or tax increases.
Is there anything you wanted to add? You want to talk about the stimulus?
Okay. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. The next page just itemizes the federal stimulus package and some of the assumptions that were included in the governor's budget recommendations. This is an unusual situation for the governor to anticipate federal legislation, but it is certainly a material element of this budget and this budget cycle. As you know, We have two major unknowns in this budget recommendation. One is the economic uncertainty that the commissioner referenced up front. We know that the GDP is deteriorating somewhat. On the other hand, we also know that the federal government is planning major action to try and address the economy and, in particular, provide aid to states. In the governor's budget, he provides some assumption for the federal stimulus package, not necessarily a maximum amount, but a $920 million assumption of direct state aid. We've seen figures in over $3 billion in total state aid for the state. I wanted to underline and underscore that that will not likely be available to the state and certainly wouldn't be all available for direct general fund budget resolution. Some of that will be for capital projects, other entities. So there will be some significant amount of money for the state, but in this budget we're just making the simple assumption of $920 million. This assumption will be updated once we have final legislation. Hopefully, that will be done in time for the February forecast. That will allow the legislature to have a new baseline of revenues and expenditures, including the impact of the federal stimulus package and the economic and direct aid assumptions that would go with it. And it will then allow the governor to also reprice and adjust his package based upon the requirements in that. The good news for this budget period is also that the federal stimulus is expected to impact not only fiscal 10 and 11, but also fiscal 9. As a result, hopefully some of that money will be available retroactively, will help us address some of the fiscal 2009 issues should they come up through revenue shortages. The last page just summarizes the entire budget, showing 2008 and 9, 2010 and 11. As I mentioned, we are assuming some of the federal revenue coming in fiscal 9 that leads to the balance in that biennium. However, that is the rest of that is used in the 10 and 11 solution, leaving a final balance of $11 million. With that, that concludes our presentation. We'll be happy to entertain any questions. $11.
Okay, thank you.
Pretty close.
Certainly. Irrespective of what we think of the budget or we don't think of the budget, recognize it's very difficult for both of you and the department to promulgate a budget under these circumstances. And obviously, you've attempted to work within constraints that none of us would have wanted or expected, at least to the extent that that you were forced to do so. Having said that, I'm sure many of us have questions. I'd like to, if I can, just pursue a couple of areas. First, you've talked about what's happening in Washington, and I guess my experience over the years has always been that it's always difficult to predict what may or may not happen. And you read and hear about what's taking place, whether in terms of policy, personnel, or whatever, and there's a degree of uncertainty. So I should mention to members that both the commissioner and Mr. Showalter have heard a couple of these concerns expressed to me from before. They spent a lot of time last week with myself and representatives Carlson and Solberg, so I certainly appreciated that time because that offered a clearer look at some of what you were thinking. But in the presentation, you talk about understates potential amount providing the cushion for the February forecast. My sense is, I would assume, Mr. Schulter, you've been in touch with OMB people or somebody or NCSL, whatever, or the National Governors Association, probably in your instance, to have some sense. But when I read, I've only had a chance to talk to a couple of people, I get the sense that it might not be understated. But just hypothetically, let's say as this thing proceeds, I mean, just hypothetically, if the president wants to maintain or regain or have some Republican support for the stimulus package, what pieces get dropped, what pieces get added in order to do so, as an example? Obviously, there are some differences between the Senate and the House in terms of packages. So what happens if, in fact, it has not been understated in terms of a potential amount.
Mr. Chair, members, excellent question. And the nature of the question underscores the difficulty of assuming anything in this budget, because it literally changed the assumptions and the information we got literally changed every day as we were approaching production final decisions of the governor's budget. By the time we were producing the governor's budget, we had new information within a week afterwards. It is a moving target, and I think what you're referring to is the nature of how much is the state's going to get out of the total stimulus package. You know, I think the high watermark seemed to be last week, where everyone was expecting, you know, for Minnesota's case, several billion dollars for sure, maybe more. And now, as the package starts to change, state's share probably will start to decline as other elements come in. I don't have a crystal ball as to what that's going to happen. I do know that if it gets enacted, you know, we will fold whatever assumptions we can from that stimulus package into the forecast along with the new economic information. If, in fact, you know, 920 is not a understated number, but is in fact just exactly the number, and we have a worse economic scenario, obviously then our March forecast would look markedly worse.
And certainly, I mean, I realize it's difficult to predict that, but that's an uncertainty. And in the same way, we might have some guesses on what takes place with the March 3rd forecast. We don't know for a fact. And we might have some guesses on a federal stimulus package. But I guess what concerns me, in just in a general sense, is obviously some of the governors, and some governors pretty close to the president, have talked to him, have met with him, asking for, you know, more direct money. And my sense is that that's not the direction they're going in. But obviously, we have to wait and see. The other question relative to the federal money is this talk about eligibility and whether or not the FMAP money, and Commissioner, you made reference to the maintenance of effort that will be required. Depending on strings attached, I think you showed us the division that the FMAP match is, what, about two-thirds, I think, of the 920? Am I saying that correctly, that two-thirds is the FMAP and about one-third is, what, special ed? Is that correct?
It's the stabilization fund. There's a roughly, in specific state terms, about $1 billion currently assigned for Minnesota for stabilization. It's pretty much open-ended with some maintenance of effort requirements on education funding, and we're trying to understand exactly what are the parameters for that education maintenance of effort. There's also some really open-ended general support for states that is part of that block grant that doesn't have an MOE.
What about this question of eligibility in terms of the FMAP end of it? Is that not something to be concerned about, or is that something to be concerned about?
Mr. Chair, that is certainly something to be concerned about. As we find out exactly what that final package is, I think the governor will have to assess what, if any, changes he would want to make to his budget package in order to draw down that FMAP. Now, our preliminary information suggests between $200 million, perhaps up to $400 million of eligibility changes may be necessary in order to conform to maintenance of effort requirements.
But doesn't that have other impacts on your budget then in terms of what you're doing with eligibility? I mean, you're decreasing eligibility. If it appears once this package has passed and you've had a chance to study it more closely, that, and if it becomes kind of a black or white kind of situation, that we don't get the money if there is any change in any eligibility, you know, if it's presented that starkly, that creates some problems in terms of what you'd like to do.
But, Mr. Chairman, it's the medical assistance program. We have state-only programs, Minnesota Care and General Assistance Medical Care, that the federal money doesn't touch, and it's within their maintenance of effort will not touch. We would, in order to receive the federal money, it would be to our best interest to forego the 200 to 300 to 400 million in cuts we now have and restore them to the maintenance of effort levels to get the whatever money.
Okay, but if you have to have a restoration of 200, 300, $400 million, that's not insignificant.
No, it isn't. And in fact, if, say, for example, above the, just for purposes of example, it's $1 billion above the 920. Well, and if we have to back off $400 million in our to get the maintenance of effort, you're really netting $600 million.
Yeah, and obviously, what state governments have wanted to do and have done, I think the governor's done it, is to seek waivers from the federal departments. I would guess this administration won't be granting any of those waivers, at least relative to eligibility. I'd be very surprised if there'd be waivers granted. So, and obviously I recognize that we have, that even with the presentation and the work you've done, that it's certainly a work in progress in that regard, with so much dependent on what happens, to the east of us, difficult to have an exact answer. So I want to inquire that. I've got some other questions, but I'm going to ask other members. I do want to point out, Mr. Mossman pointed out just one thing in terms of comparing apples to oranges, that and we know how good his numbers are, that in terms of the fund balances, you look at the general fund balance for 08-09, I'm sorry, for 10-11, the general fund expenditures of $33.61 billion. But as Mr. Mossman pointed out to me, that includes taking the healthcare access fund into the general fund, whereas the 08-09 does not do so. That if you made, I'm just here as a mouthpiece for Mr. Mossman right now, but if you did apples to apples, the 08-09 would be 35.34 if you put the healthcare access fund in with the general fund. So that cuts actually come to a somewhat larger amount of more of closer to 5%.
For the record, which slide are you looking at, Mr. Chair?
This is the budget bottom line slide. Yeah, I'm just speaking on cue, and I'm going to turn to the guy who runs the show in a second. But
we have confidence Mr. Mossman has figured it out.
So
the part of the presentation challenge here is, you're absolutely right, in 08-09, Healthcare Access Fund is a separate fund. In 10 and 11, the governor's recommendations are for it to be considered and as part of the general fund and included into it. So for presentation's purposes, we've tried on the growth rates to include it so that we show it as if they are both in 08-09, but there are instances where we're just stating what the 08-09 spending is, and that may be the case.
And I know Senator Ferguson had some questions initially. Let me just make another comment, at least relative to the Healthcare Access Fund. And obviously, it's no secret to anybody here that's been a very contentious issue between the administration and the legislature, certainly the Senate. Putting aside the advisability of in past budgets, drawing money from the Healthcare Access Fund, putting it into the general fund, where now you just abolish the Healthcare Access Fund, I think the fear is maybe threefold. First, as I recall, when the provider tax first passed, the Healthcare Access Fund was originally established, the providers in the state, the MDs, were pretty strongly in opposition to imposition of the tax. And now I find, and this is not based upon any empirical data, but just my sense of doctors I know, the response we get from the Medical Association and so on, that they're supportive of the tax when they have now recognized what it's done in terms of the extension of healthcare eligibility. But if we take that out and just throw it into the general fund, and so now it's competing with everything else in the fund, do we lose the political support for that tax and maybe create other budget concerns? Second, it's my understanding that at least in the future, isn't that there's projected to be maybe some kind of a deficit within the fund. I'm less certain about that. But certainly if that's the case, then clearly the eligibility will be in competition even more so than today with corrections or other parts of the budget. And so I think those are a couple of not insignificant concerns that the I think people in the Senate have. I don't know if you want to comment on that or.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I think on the first point, the growth rate for healthcare spending is, you know, in any given year between 8 and about 11% per year. And so the notion that the provider tax will ultimately go for other than non-healthcare purposes is extraordinarily unlikely. The long-term trend in the general fund has been that healthcare uses a growing portion of the total healthcare expenditures. That's true this year, and it's true even in the governor's budget. So, you know, for the provider tax, it is pretty clear that it's still going to be going for healthcare purposes. To support the Minnesota Care Program, to support the General Assistance Medical Care Program, medical assistance, you can choose how you want to talk about it or how you want to frame it, but there's still clearly a growth in healthcare expenditures to which that those revenues can be applied, and it's necessary just to even support the current the proposed level of healthcare spending. As far as the deficit in the future, you are right that if under current law the estimates are that there were expansions that were approved last year. As you continue out into the future, it would be expected that those expansions would probably outstrip the growth of the provider tax. The governor's proposal reduces eligibility, does not include those expansions. And so in terms of balance, long-term balance, the merger doesn't create a structural, doesn't worsen the general fund structural problem. It probably improves it.
Just parenthetically, it seems to me that was one of the concerns with the MVEST monies, that when we put it into the general fund and then it was up against all other parts of the fund, those involved with the imposition of that tax objected, and of course we then constitutionally dedicated it. Senator Fredrickson, you had some questions?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I have one question and then a comment, and I'm not sure that you have any more information to share with the committee. It's about the federal stimulus, $920 million that you're recognizing. And I was just curious how you arrived at that 920, if you had more specifics available to you than we have by reading some of the accounts that come across our desk. Kind of responded to that with the chairman, but yes, specifics as to what the program might be, or
it's Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson. It's roughly a 4.9% FMAP we assumed, but you know we get our source of information from our state budget officers association, from the NGA. From Governor Pawlenty, talking to Governor Doyle and other governors. So I have a conference call with the congressional delegation tomorrow where I'm sure I'll find out more information. It was just our best guess, and we wanted to make it more on the conservative side. Because remember, we have the, you know, that's the upper for the end of February, but, you know, we have the downside risk of the forecast, and hopefully this will go up, and hopefully this will go up more than this will go down, and we'll all be okay.
Is that how you do it, this and that's
Mr. Chairman, I think we're supposed to arrive at an equilibrium in there somewhere.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, if I could just add for the record, I just have one small addition on top of that 4.9% for the fiscal stabilization fund. A fraction of the available amount for Minnesota was also included in that estimate.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I do have a just a comment on one of the other items of the that's the tobacco appropriation bonds for 20 years. That means 10 bienniums from now, our successors sitting around this table in your chair will still be paying off those bonds. Thinking back to some of the first years that I was in the Senate, in the 1930s, there had been some kind of a farm assistance program where they...
That's when you started?
I started in the 80s.
Oh, okay.
But there's a farm assistance program that ultimately was backed by state GL bonds, and some of those loans had gone bad for the farmers, and it was in the 1980s before all those bonds were paid off, and I can remember some of the old-timers that were around here then were saying, finally, we've paid off those bonds or the program that went bad in the 1930s. And I'm just wondering how our successors will feel 10 biennium from now paying off something that we did for the 10-11 biennium, if they're not going to wonder, why didn't they either raise some fees, taxes, or cut programs to balance it in 10 and 11? Just my own personal reaction to that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fredrickson, if I could respond, I look at it as a budget tool in bad times. When we, if you recall back to 2003, and you know, we had deficits in 3, 4, and 5, but we used up the shift in our budget reserve by 2003, but we had statutory language in place, we paid back the budget reserve up to the $650 million, and we paid back the budget reserve in 2007 and 2006. So we made it a priority to restore those tools that we use in bad times. I know the governor and I envision this to be not paid back over 10 bienniums, but when things turn up again, we will we will pay this back.
But Commissioner, just to follow up on that, obviously in 2003, when there was utilization of significant one-time money in the budget, the tobacco endowment, I think with the workers' comp fund, those amounts were never paid back. Obviously, we rebuilt the reserve, and now, of course, we've reduced the reserve, and that's what it's there for. But I don't want to speak for Senator Fredrickson, but I would share his concern that in this instance, we're talking about a much longer period of time, and there'll be other priorities, the kind of things we have bought back, the K-12 shift, the budget reserve, and I certainly applaud your intent to include $250 million in rebuilding the reserve. I would hope maybe we could even figure out a way to improve on that, whether it's by $50 million, $100 million. I think we would all like to do that. I've got a couple of questions about that as well, but I would distinguish how we've built back some of what took place in 2003 versus this particular approach. Senator Betzel.
Well, and along those lines, too, Mr. Chair, I think we need to get an idea of how much within this budget we're just pushing off some debt and obligations into the future. The obvious one is the delayed payments for K-12, but for instance, just yesterday we looked in the State Government Budget Division at the cost of this leased purchase for technology. It does get the technology in earlier, but then we have to make out long-range obligations. We're going to be paying more in the long run for it than if we would just buy it in the future. So, and I don't know within the whole budget, how many areas we're incurring future debt to pay for the current obligations. That's just one of those areas that we looked at yesterday, and there may be more. And I think sooner than later we probably want to get a list of some of the things that we're going to be, what the future costs are, to pay for this current budget.
Well, it's something that we've had discussions about, and I don't know if the department wants to provide that list. We can certainly promulgate, and Mr. Mossman, that may be a pretty good idea if we can promulgate. As Senator Betzel suggests, some sense of the borrowing aspects as opposed to the pure one-time aspects. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, that makes me think about the comment that was made about charging an extra fee to use the online licensing proposal that you're doing. Out there in the real world, people expect to pay less when they use the online service, not pay more. So I think that's a little
pay more for the convenience.
Backwards, I'll just say that. It might be worth just raising the fee a couple of dollars or whatever you were envisioning across the board or something like that. But that's we'll be ridiculed out there in the rest of Minnesota for that proposal. And then the other question I had was about the North Star Care for Children program. Is that a new program, that, or is this a program I just don't know the name of?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, that is a new program. It's basically the Department of Human Services looking at adoptive services, foster care, out-of-home placement services, and trying to make sure that the reimbursement rates are equalized so that there's not a change or an incentive incentives that are that the incentives work for the children so that they have more permanency and that it works better at a county level. So that's just a new name for trying to manage those programs and those rates in a seamless way.
You're kidding.
Yeah. So it's just a new name for existing work.
It is, except that it's a different approach, trying to make sure that each of those programs and the rates and the programs are looked at together rather than as separate programs.
Okay. And then may I ask one more question?
Sorry. Yes.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Showalter, the bullet that says tie chemical dependency spending to performance, could you explain how in reality that might work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, the current program essentially provides a rate for services. So if an individual qualifies and receives services in a county, the county will direct them to a service provider, and they will seek treatment, and they will be reimbursed based upon the whatever rate happens to be there. DHS, the Department of Human Services, proposing to change that around so that the rates for each provider are based upon the recidivism, the success rates of that individual program, so that higher quality programs, programs that seem to work for individuals, will have better rate structure than those that may not indeed help the individuals as much. Hopefully over the long term, that will just help both the individual and the state.
Chair.
Sir Mitzen.
Yeah, shifting gears just a little bit. This collaboration ideas are wonderful, but this isn't anything new. We had about 10 years ago what they call the Board of Innovation and Cooperation, and it really worked well. I mean, you know, not just getting groups together like departments together like they did in Vickerman's district, or we did in Hutchinson, Minnesota, or we did out my way in Inver Grove, where there were going to be three libraries built, the college, the city, and the county. We give them like $30,000-$40,000 to talk about it. You know what happened? They built one library on the campus that served the county, the city, and the Inver Hills Community College. And part of that board had to do with, like, rulemaking stuff where you could shortcut. Instead of going in for 72 permits, there was a way that our committee could work these things out, one-stop shopping, so to speak, and help the business community to grow and expand. So I'm going to introduce, along with Senator Lori and Hilty in the House, to revitalize or to bring that that thing back. And the governor kind of picked up on it a little bit going to Wisconsin and buying salt and sand together, but I don't know how that helps so much. Well, that helps a little bit in Minnesota, but what we were doing was good things on the Board of Innovation and Cooperation. So I'll look to you guys and Senator McElroy and some others to help us get that back in gear. One more example in Hutchinson, Minnesota. There was a city salt and sand end loaders. Two blocks away was the State Highway Department, sand, salt, front-end loaders, and then the county was nearby. So the Board of Innovation and Cooperation pulled these, and they get one building now, don't they? Two front-end loaders instead of six. So I just picking up on what you said earlier about getting along and cooperation, and that those are areas where we can. Then we had villages and townships go together. Instead of two mayors, two blah, blah, blah. I could go on and on. But anyway, we're going to bring that back up and go forward with that.
Senator Mitzen, that's a good point. I just want to make clear that Governor Pawlenty was not in any way responsible for the abolition of that office. That took place prior to his becoming governor. That was former Representative Krinke's pound of flesh.
Thank you for clearing that up. It was not under Plenty, Senator or Governor Plenty's administration. Thank you, Senator Cohn.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, as long as we're talking about reinventing the wheel, I just wanted to mention that for many years, 20 years, we've been a member of an 11-state compact in higher ed called the Midwest Higher Education Compact that does group purchasing, MHEC, and not just for higher ed institutions, but also for K-12, for local governments, for nonprofits even, and for private colleges. So they do group purchasing and software and other types of entity. They're looking into some energy things right now. So I would just suggest you take a look at them.
Sir Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I, too, would like to have some kind of an idea as to what's going on in regard to the quality controls and so forth in the Health and Human Services. Over the weekend in the Star Tribune, there was a fairly lengthy article that implied that that we're delivering a lot of welfare, but to people that don't deserve it. And I guess if you're looking at, you know, quality control, you shouldn't have that. Can you tell me what the department is doing on that area?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we can certainly get back with more specifics. We certainly know that the Department of Human Services takes those kinds of concerns very, very seriously. They've instituted a number of different types of controls, but it is a large operation, and we've been working with them throughout time to try and make sure on the front end that their systems work. And I know that Commissioner Ludeman's been looking at that more seriously and continuing to look at that through the recent months as OLA findings, as other issues continue to come up. Certainly Commissioner Hansen in other venues has discussed internal controls, and we'll be looking at those statewide, not just in Human Services.
Senator Tomasoni.
Commissioner, trying to understand the tobacco appropriation thing here. Is the intent of the governor to pay all the debt service for this biennium and then for the cash also that we're going to be using to supplement the deficit? And then into the future, what's the intent of the tobacco money to be paid? Do I have that close?
Somewhat close. Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, it is a one-time $920 million pays the debt service in 10 and 11. And it's the advice, we cannot use the money that we raise from the appropriation bonds for operating costs, or that would violate our constitutional provision. So it's got to be non-operating, and that's why the only big non-operating piece of our budget we have is the debt service.
So, Mr. Chairman, so it'll only pay the debt service in 10 and 11.
That's correct.
And it'll help with which helps with the general fund obligation.
Yes.
But then we'll be paying for it. That's right. Only in 10 and 11, and then. So it helps with the deficit right now, but that bond that'll be sold will be paid for the next 20 years by the tobacco money.
That's correct.
And not any other debt service from capital costs, correct?
That's correct.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, on the county services reform, the first bullet says incent counties to consolidate and share services. Is that a financial incentive? And is it county to county, or can it also be counties to townships and cities and whoever else?
It doesn't affect townships and cities.
It's townships. I mean, it's counties. We're just looking up the total, Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins. I think the difference this time versus other in the past is their specific they get more of their county aid back that we're reducing if they consolidate. Counties that take advantage of the program will see a total reduction of 1.5. Is there a number somewhere? Okay, there is a financial incentive. We'll look at it and communicate it in a clear way, but it is a definite financial incentive for counties to consolidate.
And who are we consolidating with? Who's eligible for?
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
It is basically asking counties to consolidate with themselves so that the human services delivery system, which is currently a county-based system with one exception where there's three counties working together, that some of those counties just don't have economies to scale. That, you know, they've got many social services that only have a handful of people using those. And what this proposal envisions is bringing counties together through MOUs or joint powers agreements, whatever, to build a human services area, essentially. So the counties will be working with each other to deliver those services on a joint basis so that each one doesn't have to have a separate social services unit, economic self-sufficiency unit, healthcare unit, so on and so forth.
So, Mr. Chair,
I could add on that.
Commissioner.
Senator Higgins, the counties of less than 250,000 or greater than 100,000 would be incented to share services. Counties with larger than 250,000, which would include Hennepin, Ramsey, Dakota, would would work in collaboration with smaller counties. So you wouldn't see a scenario. Ramsey and Hennepin wouldn't be consolidating. The incentives are built in so that they work with smaller counties.
And Mr. Chair, that was part of my question. Is I can see how this would be a good thing for the smaller counties to work together, but the big counties, it's hard to think about them combining.
Mr. Chair, Senator, and this would not be asking them to combine. We're not asking the bigger counties to combine. Their bar is actually different. Their standard is simply to offer some of their services on a fee-for-service basis to other counties so that where they may have expertise, they can offer to other counties and get their aids back as well.
Okay. Senator Higgins, if counties do not take advantage of the consolidation, they'll see a 4.4% of levy plus aid reduction in calendar years 9 and 10. If they do take advantage, it's a 2.97% of levy plus aid in 9 and 10.
Let me ask Senator Murphy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, mine is more just a comment than anything else. But, this is one of the most disappointing budget documents that I think that in the 17 sessions that I've been here that any governor has delivered. It's very disappointing. The governor has always maintained that not only do we have to take care of our budget problems for the current biennium, but we also have to get out to the next one and the next one. And so I see that he's leaving about $2.5 billion in today's dollars, and when the next forecast comes in, it's probably going to be about $3.5 billion in the 12-13 fiscal years accounted for. It's leaving a big hole there. So that kind of runs contrary to where to what we've tried to do in the past and what the governor has always demanded. The other thing is I just don't understand why we continue with QCOMP. If the governor wants to give teachers a pay raise, why don't he just call it a pay raise, give them a pay raise, and be done with it? But QCOMP has absolutely, in my opinion, and I think there's a lot of people who would agree, there's no way to say that it's done anything at all. And I would like to just see it go away. I think that there's better uses of those resources, and we should capture that money And if nothing else, put it on the formula. Or use it for debt reduction. One of the two. And the other thing, you know, all these tax cuts for businesses and everything, I think that we've got 8 years of history that show that that doesn't do much good right now. And, you know, so I'm kind of disappointed that the governor continues to roll out all of these ideas that have been tried and proven not to work. And I was very disappointed that he didn't take care of the tails on the budget. And my hope is that the Senate shows a little bit of leadership and actually puts together a budget document that is responsible, because this one is not.
Okay, that's a vote no. Any comments?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, I don't think these are ordinary times. I would love to see our tails solved. But in an economy where thousands of jobs are being shed, where the federal government has a $1.2 trillion deficit, and a newly elected Democratic, arguably liberal president is going to significantly cut our taxes to add to that deficit, tells you and tells all of us that the need to help people push as much money out into the economy as possible is critical. That is why you see some of the – that's why you see a shift. That's why you see the appropriation bonds. We are trying to cushion the people of our state from bad economic times.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
And Mr. Chairman, what tax are you going to raise, Senator Murphy? I mean, that's really the question.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, there it was, the baiting. I knew it was coming. I knew you were going to try to bait into some sort of tax.
But how are you – you have to solve it. If you're going to fix the 2.5, what are you going to raise?
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I'm just saying that this document is the most disappointing that I've seen in 17 sessions. It doesn't do the trick. And the other thing is that some of the and I don't disagree. There's going to be a lot of pain. And we just need to tell educators that there's going to be a cut to K-12 education, period. We need to tell Health and Human Services there's going to be a hardline cut, transportation, right across the board. I'd rather see a 15% cut right across the board than to bring this, because this doesn't do the trick. And when you're talking about those tails, we better be keeping an eye on those tails, because 2 years we're going to be back and the problem's going to be worse than what we have today. So we need to keep an eye on the future, but this document doesn't do it. I mean, like I said, there's all kinds of little gimmickry in there, and let's shift things around. And at the end of the day, I'm not going to have my way. If I had my way, this thing would be rectified, period. And would there be some tax increases? Yes. For all the people that are listening, yes. There would be. Which ones? I'm not quite sure yet, but there would be. But it would be a lot more fair than this. We're going to give businesses a huge tax cut. We're going to give more money to K-12 education. And that just means more people are going to go hungry. More people are going to be cold and not clothed. More people are going to be cold and not housed. I think that if we're going to do the best for the people of our state, Commissioner, that we need to try putting a better first foot forward.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, just to, if you don't like the tobacco appropriation bonds and you don't like the K-12 shift, both which are one-time resources, there's a $2.214 billion hole right there, just to get you back to the governor's numbers. So there's your tax increase, and then you add to that.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, we can still cut $2.5 billion out of the budget. But somebody's going to have to step forward and show a little bit of leadership. And if it is the Senate that has to do that, it will be the Senate that will do it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, not to belabor it, but if you are going to lead, you'll be leading on cuts to K-12 education, because the governor will not.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, what do you think those shifts are? If those shifts aren't cuts, I don't know what are. I mean, you can either die with a bloody axe or a million paper cuts. Which way do you want it?
It's an interesting metaphor.
reminds me of that Budweiser beer commercial where the guys got
Senator Rickman.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't like a lot of these cuts, but I will still thank the governor for leaving veterans alone and military affairs alone. And I'm going to be sure that that stays that way because we owe something to those soldiers that come back here. So I don't like part of it, but that part I do like. He did leave them alone.
Commissioner, let me, maybe in a little bit more of a low-key way, follow up on Senator Murphy. You've made the comparison to 2003, and I recognize, you know, the cliche is, boy, I sure wouldn't want to have your job, and this year that cliche might be more true than ever.
Or yours.
But I think a concern I have as I've tried to absorb the budget since last week is that, so if you look to 2003, the expectation was that we'd come out of that recession, the 2001 recession, and there would start to be some growth for that next biennium, some economic growth. That it was a more traditional recession. I think the economists talked about it as being, in fact, an investor recession, not a consumer recession, which possibly was the underpinning of some of the problems we have right now. But I think there's wide acknowledgement, and I'm sure not an economist, but I think there's wide acknowledgement that this particular recession is unique, at least in our lifetimes. And so a budget that's constructed on the 2003 models doesn't work quite as well, that we don't expect the growth in the next biennium. And that being the case, to then predicate the budget on so much one-time money, leaving that much more of a deficit in the out years, when we don't expect the ability to grow out of it, as was the case in 2003, I think raises other concerns. Now, I don't want to suggest that at the end of the day or over the history that the legislature has been just perfect in this regard. Let's just go back last year. The House proposed and the Senate ultimately with maybe not alacrity, but I think a little bit too quickly certainly, grabbed the cash flow account. There was an unwise move, and that was not suggested by the administration. And that's something we're not going to do this year. So it's not that we have some degree of complicity with the utilization of one-time money. And I would have to admit, I think to get out of this year's session, absent the use of one-time money, will be very, very difficult. But when we see the size of the deficit in the out years at $2.5 billion, and when we see the utilization of federal money where I'm not sure I would – if I was in your position, I'm not sure I would handle it differently given where we are right now relative to where we think the federal government might be. But there is some potential weakness there. Certainly a unique approach relative to this approach with tobacco bonds, which I want to ask a couple questions about in a minute. But I do think there's a certain irony, though, and some members are going to recall – Senator Frederickson certainly will – there was never any discussion of an out-year budget. Nobody cared. That was my sense. And my first term in the Senate and when I was in the House, when Governor Perpich was governor, nobody cared. Now, I have to admit, my first term here, I was chairman of nothing other than, I think, the Data Privacy Subcommittee and wasn't room for me on the Finance Committee. So I guess, nobody thought about an out-year budget. The irony, to be fair, is the person who lectured the legislature repeatedly was Governor Carlson. And Governor Carlson and Senator Frederickson, correct me if I'm wrong in my paraphrase, but Governor Carlson said, in effect, you spend as much money as you want, but we're going to have a balanced budget for the out years. He was the person who forced that discipline. Now, I'm not suggesting that we ought to – that there's going to be the ability to have an absolutely balanced out year's budget. I mean, obviously during the Carlson two terms, we didn't have the kinds of economic problems that we face now. But I do think there's a degree of irony that it was Governor Carlson who imposed that discipline, and now Governor Pawlenty, who has a greater out year deficit than we've ever seen. So, and I don't want to place blame in its entirety on Governor Pawlenty to the extent that these are unusual times, but I am a little bit concerned that the degree of deficit for the out years, given where the economy is likely to go, puts us in a position that come that 12-13 budget in 2 years, it might be insurmountable without some just massive tax increase, an unsustainable tax increase. So that does concern me. And like I said, I'm not suggesting that we're not without some complicity in that. Again, I referenced the use of the cash flow account last year, which was, you know, that was only a year ago, and that was clearly inadvisable. And ultimately, of course, we didn't do it, and we weren't going to do it. But, you know, that was our way of, you know, dragging bills to the floor on the House side, and we at some point in the Senate did so as well. So that's – I can't think of any – Senator Murphy, any metaphors like you use, though. So,
Mr. Chairman.
I can think up of a couple.
Senator Foley.
Mr. Chairman, what – all of this projected federal funds are one-time money – how are we going to do with the results after that money is spent?
That's the point. It's one-time money.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator, was it Tomasoni?
Commissioner, just out of curiosity in regards to your question to Senator Murphy, I know you have some minimal fee increases in the bill, and I'm not sure what they are, but and I know the governor doesn't consider fees to be taxes, and I know he doesn't consider property taxes to be taxes. So what would the governor be in favor of any kind of revenue raisers?
No.
Okay, good answer.
Senator Dave.
Mr. Chairman.
Speaking of metaphors.
Yeah. It's interesting to listen to the discussion around the table about fees or trying to shift some money to make do, and I think that's wonderful that we're talking like that, because we're not like the federal government that can just go and print the money. Now they're just producing billions and billions of dollars, and if I remember right, it was like 11 Democrats and all Republicans voted against that. So the makeup in Minnesota seems to be a little bit different than the makeup in Washington, D.C., as it comes to putting together a package. And we're, you know, I compliment the governor on no, starting out at least with no taxes. If, like Senator Murphy says, if that, you know, if that comes to be, that comes to be. But let's not start off with the tax increases. That I think that it was kind of interesting. I mean, actually, out of 201 legislators, it seems to me like a good share of them have been salivating as they walk around the halls listening to what the federal government, how they're going to balance our budget. The federal government, because they're printing money, is going to balance our – I mean, in all honesty, I wouldn't mind doing it without their package. I haven't quite figured out the ratio of what we have to send them and what we get back, and if it's that we send them a lot more than we get back, I guess I'd be a little remiss not in doing that. So it's just kind of interesting. I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, it's kind of different. In Washington, D.C., they're just printing money and coming out with all the programs and telling us how great we're going to be. And here, at least, and I compliment our committee, we're actually trying to solve some things, and whether or not we don't like shifts or we don't like whatever, so be it. So you got a package. We got it started. We've been here long enough. I think this is my 18th year. I remember when we were talking about Carlson. Maybe Carlson did do that. If he did do that, that's about the only thing I could say that he did do good in the 8 years that I was here with him. So we know he didn't do anything for transportation. So as far as him being different than Plenty, oh, my goodness, there's a big difference between those two. Thank you.
Senator Day, I think that obviously you raised the concern, and all of us are a little bit jealous of the ability of the federal government to deal with this in a way that we can't. But I'd be remiss if I didn't stretch the analogy that when you talk about the printing of money and so on. I think, Commissioner, again, stretching the analogy, that's a little bit of the concern. If I could maybe get back to just a separate from all of our speeches, a little bit of the concern with the bonding for the tobacco, that it seems to be a stretch. Now, you indicated, I think, that the attempt by other states to securitize their tobacco funds did not that wasn't selling. Was that correct?
Mr. Chair, in previous years, I think it's something like 16 other states. Don't quote me on that number, but about that number of states have already sold tobacco bonds. Nobody has sold anything recently. In recent months, general obligation debt hadn't been selling, and that's part of the whole economic crisis that we're talking about. It's our expectation, based upon the secondary market, that a new true securitization of tobacco revenues would be difficult to sell and probably would be priced very highly. That is, we'd pay a very high interest rate if we were even able to find a willing buyer.
And let's make sure members understand that the securitization approach of other states is the outright sale, where you are giving up that asset forever. In this case, you're borrowing against the asset, but maintaining the asset for use X number of years down the road. And I asked this question privately, Mr. Showalter, but with this approach, if there is some other unusual situation in the bond and credit markets, that kind of, if it doesn't throw it out the window, creates some real problems for it, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, we tried to, as we discussed that day, this proposal tries to take that into account, that, you know, assuming a even modestly functioning credit market, this probably will be saleable. But that's based upon, you know, our best guess of what's going to happen in the future. Assistant Commissioner Kathy Cardell can certainly speak more definitively to that. But in her conversations with her colleagues in the private sector as well as the public sector, we felt that these would be a saleable asset.
Senator, just to follow, or Mr. Chairman, to follow up on that, there is risk in any budget we do. Remember back to my first slide where we passed the budget at the end of the 2007 session. We predicted we passed a budget based on a lot more revenue than we ended up receiving. So but there's risk to every some level of risk to what we do.
And what's the trade-off if we – and I know everybody around this place has a lot of fun with a bonding bill but what's the downside in the absence of a bonding bill this year or next year, where now you have economists suggesting, as they have not in the past, that in this kind of economic circumstance, that does become a significant stimulus? And I think if there's any, I don't know about unanimity, probably not quite that far, but certainly the broad range of national economists suggests that the important piece of the federal package is the infrastructure piece, and that can make a difference. If we take that ability away from what we're doing within the state, what's the trade-off in that regard?
Mr. Chair, I'm not quite sure I follow, because I don't know that this would take away that ability to.
Well, I think you're proposing no bonding bill this year, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm sorry. So you're saying if the governor or this session doesn't enact a bonding bill and there's some requirement for matching funds in order to draw down the federal funds? it is true that the governor's budget currently does not include any assumption of that. That would cost federal construction projects if that were what happened.
Let me just indicate that I think that this morning's hearing, which is, Mr. Anderson, I know you have a question in a second, that this morning's hearing, which is quite useful, I don't think we have the opportunity to get a fuller exposition of that particular part of the proposal. I think certainly in terms of, you know, do we think it's a good idea to cut higher ed versus K-12, and is the QCOM program working or not? Obviously, that's in the normal discourse of the divisions and in putting together the totality of the budget. We understand the uncertainty of the federal money. That's something beyond the scope of the department or this committee at this stage. We have to see what happens. But at some point, I'd like to have maybe a further discussion, possibly with bond counsel, maybe with competing bond counsels or something, to make sure we understand it. I've tried to spend some time with it, and I think I have some sense of it, but I still have questions. And several minutes is probably not going to lend itself to a fuller exposition. Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, while metaphors and analogies are floating around, I'm trying to wrap my head around the tobacco appropriation bonds. And so the Senator Pappas and I, the best metaphor or analogy, I should say, we came up with is we'd be borrowing, and maybe I'm wrong in how I'm envisioning this, but we're borrowing money to pay off another debt that we have for capital. Mm-hmm. And so the kitchen table analogy in plain English would be we're going to use our credit card, go get a cash advance, borrow money on our credit card, pay interest on it to pay our mortgage. So we're going to pay interest on our to pay back. We're going to borrow money to pay for our borrowed money. And if I'm understanding this correctly, that's the analogy that is sort of the plain English explanation of this. And to me, Senator Day, I appreciate what you said. We can't print money, and that's probably a good thing. But this, to me, seems dangerously too much like what the federal government can do, which is just borrow against our children's future and use deficit spending to pay for today's debts. And so I don't see it as a responsible, long-term, better way than what we're seeing in Washington in terms of deficit spending. I think we're starting to go down that road. I mean, it's not exactly deficit spending, but it's borrowing against borrowing is not a good road to start going down.
That's not a bad analogy. Robbing Peter to pay Paul would be the new testimony.
That's a new one.
I'm not a real expert on that, but that would be another one. Sarah Murphy.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, don't get me wrong. I do believe that there is an appropriate use for bonding at the state level. I don't know if paying off ongoing debt or using the profit from the sale of the bond to enhance spending programs, I don't know if that's quite appropriate, but there is a lot of room in this budget discussion for ideas like selling bonds, for example. But, I still think and truly believe that the Senate is going to have to show a little bit of leadership here, and I would hope that the governor could partner with us or at least not get in the way. What I would like to see happen is a budget document come forward that that balances the budget, that gets away from the borrow and spend mindset that we have degraded into over the past few years. Something that's honest, straightforward, balances the budget this biennium, next biennium. And that way, the people in the state of Minnesota will know exactly how bad the ox goring is going to get, because everybody's ox is going to get gored here. I talk to constituents all the time that I don't think understand the gravity of the situation at the state level. And a lot of them, like Senator Anderson said, think that we have a printing press down in the basement and can just generate money. And it's just not so. And I really feel that after this next forecast comes out here in the beginning of March, that, you know, we should sit down with the governor and at least provide the leadership to start that discussion on something that's open and honest and straightforward so that the people of our state can understand where we're at. We're not in a good spot, and it's going to get worse. We all know that. And, you know, we can sit around and say, oh, well, we're going to make $10 on this program, but, you know, when July rolls around you know, we've only made $2, you know, then we're going to be looking at cutting more money. I don't want to see us getting into a cycle where, and I'm sure that Senator Cohen mentioned it before I was here, where we were having special sessions every 2 or 3 weeks to get from one budget cycle to the next. I don't want that to happen. I don't think the people of the state of Minnesota are going to be real happy if we go through that. So I could give my sandwich analogy that Senator Cohen likes so much. You know, it's a rotten sandwich, and we're just going to have to pass it around. Everybody's going to take a bite.
Ew.
I don't
not
like going
to be happy. That's the way it is.
I don't like that analogy.
I know you don't like that analogy.
I thought I'd
bring it up anyway.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't like the million paper cut and the hatchet one either.
I thought that one was pretty great.
I choose the million paper cut, though.
You'd choose a million paper cuts?
Before we get
carried away. I don't know. I just want to get it over
sandwich.
With. Okay.
Before we get
sandwich.
Carried away with these analogies.
But
Senator Cohen, my point is that there's not going to be a department that's going to get an increase in spending. I mean, that's just fool's talk to even think that way. And, you know, we just need to sit down, sharpen the pencils, do what needs to be done. If the governor says he's not going to sign a tax increase, we need to sit down and figure out how we get there.
Okay. Other questions? Analogies?
I have a quick one. I do get asked all the time about what we send the federal government and what we get back. Is there a way of knowing that? Is there a percent? That way I could tell my constituents when I...
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it is a knowable figure. I don't know it. We were trying to...
We'll get it to you. I think it's in the 70, you know, for every dollar we pay in, we get about
80 cents, I think it is.
Well, less than that, I bet.
Senator Dilth.
Mr. Chairman, members, my understanding from reading something in some recent information I just read, we get 70 cents back for every dollar we send in. And I think we rank 49th out of 50 states in terms of getting federal money back.
Yes, Chair, Senators, and those figures are based upon, you know, a broad set of federal spending. Minnesota doesn't have any military bases, doesn't have much of a material production either, so we fall way behind in those areas. We tend to do better than average on some of the transfer payments, Medicaid, things like that. But on the other hand, we're richer than many other states, and so we get less federal match. So on net, yeah, we tend to come out relatively poorly.
It's a good sign.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, one of the items that you haven't talked about at all is the public safety and corrections budget, other than to just say protect it. In the 12 years I've been here, we have doubled the number of people that we have incarcerated in this state. And I'm wondering whether you all had any conversations about the wisdom of continuing enhanced sentences. We have 700 and some people there for felony DWIs. And yet the only budget cutting proposal that I saw in Department of Corrections, for example, is taking people out of the retirement program that the public safety employees have and making it only now for people who have direct contact for some certain amount of time per week. And for members who many of you probably know more about this than I do, but we allow those employees to retire at 55, and then we pay a gap until they in their health care until they're eligible for Medicare. And the governor proposes to take that benefit away. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of fascinated that that's the only innovation, idea, anything that came out of the administration for that part of the budget.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Higgins is right. As a matter of fact, I've got several phone calls from people at the Red Wing Correctional Facility who deal with the most violent of violent youthful offenders. I mean, they're serious. And, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids, you know, when we were that age, weren't 6'4 and 240 pounds. I mean, some of these kids are huge.
And violent.
And these people get put in those situations much like, you know, cops and firefighters, and that's why they have a retirement at most places at around 55. And, you know, so I was disappointed to see that. I know that the Department of Corrections needs to make cuts, but, you know, a lot of those items were negotiated amongst the members of the union and the department. And the department understood at one time that their service was very valuable and there was no way that you could do that for, you know, more than 30 years. And besides that, I don't think that you want a 60-year-old person wrestling around with a 15-year-old, 6'4", 240-pound kid. It doesn't work out very well. You need about four or five 60-year-olds, and then it might be competitive. But oh, come on, Dick. You've been down
feel
there.
I think
we'll feel that one. It just it, but theirs are about that much bigger. You know, it just doesn't make any difference. They win. But there is things that we can do in the Department of Corrections, but we need to maybe spend a little money up front to get it done. And I'm talking about electronic monitoring of those DWI, those felony DWI people, and send them home, put on one of those wrist bracelets that will contact the sheriff's department if it has one whiff of alcohol. And, you know, if they violate, then we put them in jail. But we give them the opportunity to stay out on the street and not drive and hopefully be a little more productive to society instead of spending, what's it cost Senator Higgins, $30-some thousand dollars to house somebody at 25 at Stillwater? I just don't think that that's the best use of our resource when there are things that other states are doing like this electronic monitoring. And, you know, you're talking about having either two ankle bracelets or an ankle bracelet and a wrist bracelet, one for alcohol, one to make sure that they don't leave the premises and things like that. But I think we need to be a little more creative. But these are the ideas that come about when there's a full and open discussion. And, you know, I think everybody on this committee is looking forward to those discussions with the governor and his folks.
Just to make a comment relative to that, Senator Murphy, maybe we should. And this is where we have to be a little bit careful. I talked about the use of the cash flow account last year on the part of the legislature. I forget, Senator Foley, were you the author of the felony DUI?
And I opposed it.
You opposed it. Who was the author?
Dave Johnson.
Senator Johnson, that's former Senator Johnson. So, you know, that was legislation passed by this Senate. And Senator Foley, you opposed it, but there weren't more than a handful of people on the floor who opposed it. I didn't oppose it.
I didn't.
Okay, well.
The concern there was what Senator Murphy has talked about in that it was people just voted for it because it was there. The idea was all right, except there were a great deal of people that were incarcerated for other offenses that That's the reason why when we got all of those people in Stillwater, we found out that a significant number of them were there because they had two or three offenses.
Well, we've had a good discussion of the budget. We have one bill on the agenda. I don't want to cut people off from further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
We never had a chance for the commissioner to weigh in on my questions about the public safety. And
fair enough. Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins and Senator Murphy, the retirement provision you talk about was, I know for me, one of the more agonizing things we talked about and decided on in our budget. It is that provision in the corrections plan that allows security guards at prisons and those in the state hospitals to retire at the age of 55 and have their health care paid till they're 55. The governor's provision doesn't change that retirement for people who are currently retired, doesn't change that provision for the actual guards themselves. So the 60-year-old guards and Senator Day won't be having to wrestle these. It's primarily for others in the plan, and it is our attempt at a time when people are losing their jobs by the droves in the private sector to try to bring some alignment between the private and the public sector in our retirement programs.
Sir Murphy.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I understand that, and but what's on paper doesn't match what happens in reality. In reality, you might have that counselor or that teacher at the Red Wing Correctional Facility who works in one office and has direct contact with kids more than 70% of the time. I mean, they might be a student. They might be, a counselor who has one-on-one. But in reality, here's what happens. If there's a disruption in a classroom, and say that there's, let's just say there's a dispute of some sort. It's every hand on deck. Everybody that hears the commotion, hears the alarm, hears the problem, responds. And regardless of whether you're a cook or a bottle washer or a guard carrying a nightstick. And that's the way it is because, you got a bunch of 40, 50-year-old people who are trying to wrestle down 17-year-old, kids that are, built like Terrell Owens. It's crazy. I think that we need to maybe look some other way, other place.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and also at MSOP, the counselors, the mental health workers that are there, I mean, they go home every night and they think about the things that those guys have talked to them about. It may not be a physical sort of job, but it's still, I think that those positions are still worthy of having that added benefit because of what they do on behalf of the state of Minnesota. And I know I'm going to be looking for something else in that budget because I'm not going there.
Senator Day.
Well, this is a good discussion, Mr. Chairman, because I have the largest prison. Mm-hmm. Nobody's ever mentioned this to me at all, so I'm glad you brought it up and hopefully have some people talk to me because I have more inmates than any prison in the state of Minnesota now, and nobody's contacted me at all, period.
Mr. Chair, Senator Day, may I forward you some of the emails that I've gotten from some of the employees?
They normally, Mr. Chairman, probably just send them to Democrats, but I will be glad to be a token Democrat and have them send one to me.
Outstanding.
Okay. You'll hear from them now, Senator. You'll hear from them now.
That's good.
Yeah. That's good.
Senator Tomasoni.
And, Mr. Chairman, to Senator Higgins' point about the DWI felonies, I think we have over 800 people incarcerated right now on DWI felonies, which if it's at $25,000 a year, it's over $21 million in the system. Over 450 of them never had an accident. And the bracelet thing seems to me to be a really good alternative to having to pay that much money to have people incarcerated who could be actually functioning, working people in society. So we do have to actually take a very serious look at that.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
And Senator Roebling, I believe, is still on the Council on State Government's Innovations Committee. The state of South Dakota won one of the big awards there on their new, they've been at it since 2005 or 2006. And it's a whole system of the folks with DWIs being on monitors. They actually go in and give a sample every 12 hours. And about half of the counties in South Dakota don't have a jail that people can go to give their samples. And so they're using the SCRAM monitors that Senator Murphy talked about, where they can actually detect whether there's any kind of blood alcohol level at all. And so I'm looking at that very carefully, because one of the things that I like about their program is that they're starting right away with the very first DWI. They don't wait until you're in trouble. They are with two or three. And they have had a 96.1% success rate with that program so far, which is just, you know, unbelievable. But if anybody is interested in helping work on that, I'd be happy for them.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? Senator Foley?
Just a comment. Earlier, the commissioner made some discussion about the river in front of the guy pushing the broom and moving the water and thereby protecting the IT stick in there. But that really was something that I think there was a river underneath the DOT building that's been there since the building was built, and they've known about it in MnDOT for all of those years. So I'm not sure that there was anything special went on over there. It may be more of an ongoing loss, and finally somebody had to do something. But I think that when you look at what was there and what's there now, maybe you still haven't fixed the water there or not, but it'd be interesting to hear what MnDOT has to say on that.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for coming in late, but we have a pretty big meeting going on in the E-12 division. And I don't know if you covered this, but one thing I've been trying to figure out is this tobacco appropriation bonds. And is the money not already designated for some other purpose other than paying off bonds, the future revenues? Or how do we get that, and where do we take it away from if it's already designated?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, the tobacco payments coming in due to the settlement are non-dedicated revenues to the general fund. So they're already part of our forecast of revenues and expenditures. So they're part of the budget, as you know it, of the general fund. What this proposal does is essentially says, conceptually, a portion of that revenue will be used to pay back an appropriation bond that will give us a lump sum up front, but we will lose that revenue long term over the next 20 years.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, further questions? Well, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Showalter, for this overview. Obviously, we'll continue to have further discussion and questions, and I can't say we eagerly anticipate the March 3rd forecast, but certainly we'll need some further discussion when we see the forecast and when we see what passes in Washington. So I appreciate all of your time.
Thank you. Thank you, members.
We have one bill on the agenda. We have Senate File 119. Senator Anderson. Senator Anderson moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you just adopt the division report?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, there's also two technical amendments, but let me explain the bill first. It's not an author's, since it's a second hearing. Mr. Chair, members, this bill is a request to transfer money. It would appropriate money from the DNR from an existing fund in the Natural Resources Fund and send it to the Legislative Coordinating Commission, $150,000, so that the Lessard Heritage Council can move forward with paying its expenses and hiring a staff person to administer the council before the sales tax revenue from the constitutional amendment that passed in November starts bringing revenue in. And the sales tax is projected to, well, it'll take effect July 1st, and then the first payments into the Outdoor Heritage Fund will start in August. So the Heritage Council, by law, we established it last year. We gave it a very aggressive timeline to come to the legislature with its recommendation for funding from that portion of the constitutionally dedicated funds for the habitat portion. It needs to report by April 1st, and it's an aggressive timeline, and the council has been spending many, many hours in meetings to try to meet their obligations. In the meantime, they've been incurring expenses, and as I said, the council, the Citizens Council, would like to hire a staff person to help them do their job. And right now, under the law that we passed last year, we established this Heritage Council, and members were appointed, and we said that, sort of as a placeholder, that the DNR would provide administrative support to the council. That has been occurring. A staff member from the DNR has been staffing the council, and pretty much, I'm not sure if he's technically, but much less on leave from his regular job at the DNR. And I think the legislature intended that as a temporary measure, and everybody agrees, the council, the Department of Natural Resources, agree that it makes sense for the council to go ahead and hire staff and to be able to allow this funding transfer to make that happen. I should also mention that the council was established in the legislative branch of government by us, but in our law that we passed last year, the enabling legislation. And so it also makes sense that this money would be transferred to the Legislative Coordinating Commission, that they would do the hiring. So it would be a person in the administrative or in the legislative branch of government. And the most important thing about having this law pass is that it would say that the very first sales tax revenue that comes in August, the very first money that comes in would be used to repay this $150,000. So it's a very short-term loan without any interest that would be paid just to allow the council to go ahead with its responsibilities. I have two amendments. Let me just describe those, and they're really technical. The A3 amendment just designates which account in the Natural Resources Fund the money would come from, and this is the water recreation account, and that's funded by water rec types of activities like boat license fees and also gas tax money, that some of which goes into that fund based on gas usage of boats, et cetera. So it has a healthy balance, and it's clear that this transfer would not have any negative impact on that fund. That's the A3 amendment. The A4 amendment is technical language that Mr. Watson suggested to be clear that the money originally would be appropriated from the DNR account to the LCC, and then the repayment would also be appropriated from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, from the sales tax receipts, back to the DNR, to the water rec account. So that's the additional language that's needed to do that. I have with me Mike Kilgore, who is our chair of the Heritage Council, a University of Minnesota professor, and he can speak to the need for this. We also have Darby Nelson here, who's a member of the Heritage Council as well, and there is someone from the DNR as well, and also from the Fish and Legislative Wildlife Alliance, Lance Ness, is here, and they testified in support of this bill in my committee as well.
All right, well, normally we don't take testimony in the full committee. Let's take action on the amendments, which seem to be appropriate, and then I'll get into some committee debate. You want to present what, the A3 amendment first?
Sure.
Okay. Senator Anderson moves adoption of the A3 amendment. She's explained it. Is there further further questions or debate? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And then we have, I believe, the A4 amendment. Mr. Mossman, you had suggested we should add language that would reference this as a one-time appropriation. What would you?
Mr. Chair, members, just to make clear that since the February forecast is still coming up, that the 09 appropriation doesn't get incorporated into the base as a base appropriation from the Natural Resources Fund, to just add a last sentence, so it would be on line 18, a new sentence. These are one-time appropriations.
Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, that's a great idea. Should I incorporate that into the A4 amendment?
That's what I would suggest.
Okay. Can I do that and just incorporate it, or do
yes.
we have to vote on it? Okay.
So we have the A4 amendment as presented by Senator Anderson, modified by Mr. Mossman. Is there further discussion on that? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Anderson, let me ask a couple of questions. I'm not quite sure why we need this bill. And I'll tell you why. I understand that everybody involved with the council hates the DNR. And so we don't want to use the DNR in any respect. And I've heard that discussion time and time again, not being as conversant with what the history is between the DNR and outside groups. I guess I hesitate to comment on that. I'm not quite sure I understand that. But I do know that Mr. Hubinger, on behalf of the LCC, and Mr. Hubinger, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, has indicated that it would certainly be possible to utilize UCC, Senator Anderson, that's a leftover from law school. It would be possible to utilize the LCC staff to make up this gap. And so what we're doing with this bill is we are using money that was to be otherwise used, and obviously it's non-general fund money that was to be otherwise used for conservation purposes for the purpose of hiring a temporary staff. And obviously, before you shake your head, Senator Anderson, temporary to the extent that over these first few months before the sales tax money kicks in. Obviously, I assume the staff hired is going to be a permanent staff. But with all the talk about supplanting and, you know, not covering up and so on, it seems to me that that's the first breach in terms of supplanting, that there were other ways we could have done this without a cost to the Natural Resources Fund. Because we are using money from that fund for this purpose, and that'll be money not used for other purposes for the Natural Resources Fund for which that fund was intended. So why can't we use somebody from the LCC?
Okay, Mr. Chair, let me just start by saying that when you say the Natural Resources Fund, you're referring to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the fund that will be funded by the sales tax? That's where this money will ultimately come from.
But initially use it from the Natural Resources Fund, and then we use it from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So why are we going to use the money in that way when we could use somebody from the LCC staff on a temporary basis?
Mr. Chair, let me start by saying this isn't about anybody hating the DNR. I just want to be really clear about
that. Okay,
that's
what I keep on hearing.
This is about the council did vote unanimously to support this bill moving forward because they believe that the council needs to have an independent staff person to help them administer the fund. The DNR is one of the state agencies that will be in line for funding from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So it makes sense, and I think it was contemplated by everyone. Certainly the legislature, I think, anticipated that the council would be hiring staff, and that they indicated in the statute that we passed last year, the law that we passed last year, that up to 1% of the new fund could be used for administrative expenses. And this, of course, is way under that 1%. So this doesn't violate anybody's intention, as far as I'm aware, to allow a very small portion of that sales tax to be used to administer and help support the work of appropriating those dollars for outdoors projects. So I don't think anyone would see that as a betrayal, and it's certainly not supplanting anything because none of this exists yet.
Okay.
So I think that it just makes sense that any entity that could be in line for funding wouldn't be also staffing this. And I have to say, Bill Becker is the staff person from the DNR who's been supporting the council's work, and he's been doing an excellent job. And none of this is about criticism of the work that he's been doing. He's been, you know, he's been broadly supported in his work, and I, for one, want to say that I really appreciate the good work that he's been doing for us. So it's not about that. It's about making sure that the fund is supported, the work of the council is supported by a dedicated staff who will be hired now but will be a permanent staff that will be funded by that administrative, a very small administrative portion of the new sales tax revenue.
Two questions then, Senator Anderson. One, why did we put in statute that original language about the DNR? And second, why wasn't the offer from the LCC sufficient without using money from the fund?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, I believe that we put the DNR in there sort of as a placeholder. This was intended as a transition plan. And we needed it because as soon as the election on November 5th, the DNR got to work in trying to help get the council set up and to provide support to the council. So we needed something to happen right away. And so it was a good idea to have the DNR do that administrative support. And I know Senator Fredrickson's going to help me here on. go ahead.
Senator Fredrickson?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer my recollection of what we were thinking about. I think I was on all of the conference committees considered this. We realized that the amendment passed in November, we put into law that by the 1st of December, the Outdoor Heritage Council had to be formed.
And its first meeting.
In April, they had to bring their recommendations to the legislature. But there'd be no money coming in from the new sales tax until the 1st of July. And that wouldn't be available until the 1st of August. So we talked about how can we get staff for this new that we were giving immediate functions to when the money wouldn't be coming in until July, and we picked the Department of Natural Resource to staff it because they would be the agency with the most knowledge about natural resources, and they would be most easily to staff it for this short interim period. And I think it makes good sense for this Outdoor Heritage Council to have one permanent staff on hand now. And I would expect that it would be a permanent staff and somebody with some expertise in natural resources, management of natural resources, and management of funds. So I think this is entirely in line with what we intended when we were working on this year.
And, Mr. Chair, on the issue of the LCC, I think you're talking about LCCMR staff.
I'm not sure what Mr. Hubinger was talking about, but he had indicated that it would be possible to do this without an appropriation to utilize current LCC. I don't know if it was from Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chairman, you're talking about the Legislative Coordinating Commission, which covers the commissions of the legislature, right?
Yes. Mr. Hubinger, just so I don't misstate what you had said in the meeting we had, have I misstated that, or do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. There was a multi-member conversation going on that day, and another member was suggesting that LCCMR staff might be used to support this council, and I was indicating that that was a possibility. I didn't know about their workloads, but that was something that could be explored. I think the council is indicating that that it'd be preferable to have the staff dedicated to the council's work.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
That's absolutely correct. The council was really concerned about sort of borrowing someone else's staff. Again, they want to hire a permanent person who will be dedicated to the council. The LCCMR, as you'll recall, that funding all comes from the Environmental Trust Fund and lottery dollars, so there's no general fund savings by from either one of these funds. Neither one of these are general fund dollars. So the LCCMR uses about 3-4% of their overall funds for administration. And so the LCCMR members talked about this as well and felt that their staff has a pretty big workload and it would be difficult for them to take on this additional job, and that they have, they figure, they thought that LCCMR members indicated that they thought that the it was a pretty lean operation. They didn't have a lot of, they didn't have staff spare. To spare, they essentially. Spare, no.
And Senator Anderson, this $150,000, is that for one person or is that for a multi-person staff?
Chair, I think what we contemplated was hiring a full-time staff person and perhaps an administrative assistant.
Right. And Mr. Chair, members, my name is Mike Kilgore. I'm the chair of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council. In addition to getting an initial staff person and possibly an administrative assistant, it would be also used to cover the cost for travel and reimbursement for members that attend meetings. And we're meeting once every 2 weeks, and some of our members are traveling about 250 miles one way to attend.
Is there a budget that's been promulgated in terms of staff? Or,
Mr. Chair and members, we have a we formed a personnel committee of the Outdoor Heritage Council. We have not moved any further than that until we have some funding to deal with so that we can move ahead and hire an executive director. But that would be our plan would be to develop a staffing plan for an executive director and administrative assistant, but only after funds become available.
Hey, Mr. Chair, the members that have incurred expenses, the members of this council, the citizen members, none of them have been reimbursed for their mileage or other expenses related to serving on the council. So this would allow that to happen.
Well,
so
Mr.
I think
Chair.
It's important.
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, one of the members is from my rural district. It's a five-hour drive. But he's got to go back home, so it's another five-hour drive back home if he's going to go and go home. You know as well as I do, Senator Cohen, I probably wouldn't be here if I didn't get some of my reimbursement for mileage in a place to stay. I couldn't afford to do it. And that's a good gentleman, the one down in my district. He does a lot for it, but... You know, as I said in our committee, $150,000 to administer a $500 million I see in the paper today could be. But it's not even in the ballgame. We ought to do it. I hope the rest of you will help us do it. Because my district is very conservative, and they voted at least 60 to 65% for this fund. And I want to have a red face if we go back and say, well, we don't have enough money to even operate it. That doesn't make sense. So, Senator Anderson, I hope your bill moves. I'm going to vote for it. As I said the other day, I have mixed emotions. Now I've completely changed my mind.
So
We need to pass this now because once we get in towards August, we're going to have a budget that people probably won't talk to each other before we get that all put together. Let's keep this separate.
So, Senator Anderson or Mr. Kilgore, then, is the $150,000, let's see, the 1% of the, of course, now I'm not quite sure, Mr. Mossman, where we are with the money for.
It's $76 million. Mr. Chair, I think the forecast projection is about $76 million for the habitat portion of the sales tax, which is, of course, down from what the $90 million projected. But that's based on the November forecast or December forecast.
And that will go, in all likelihood, that will go down further with the March 3rd forecast. So the $76 million, and that would be for the first year of that. That would be for the...
Well, that would be a full year, Mr. Chair, and it will be a little bit less than a full year of revenue.
So the 1% of that would be the allowance for staff complement. So is the $150,000 to be used against the 1%?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what's anticipated?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's not going to be on top of the 1%.
Oh.
All right, so if staff, if it's determined that it's appropriate to have four staffers or whatever, plus per diem mileage, other ancillary expenses, the $150,000 would be figured in that totality of the budget.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. And I think, you know, when we, by law, the Heritage Council will make recommendations and then the legislature will pass the budget. the final, you know, we'll have to appropriate the sales tax money sometime this session. And so if we have any more, you know, details about how, we'll have a budget by then, by the time we get our bill done and bring it to the legislature, that will really lay out the expenditures for the whole year. So this will be, that'll be reflected in the legacy bill.
Well, this is somewhat of a hybrid in terms of how we've handled appropriations. Is this within the, this is not within the LCC, though, or is it? Mr. Hubinger, what's your interaction with any of this?
Mr. Chair, the LCC has only reviewed the operational budget of each of the commissions, including LCCMRs, but they have not been involved in reviewing the recommendations for expenditures from the fund.
But will you be?
I don't imagine that we would be, no.
I didn't think so. So is there any check then on how that budget is promulgated, Senator Anderson?
Well, the legislature, Mr. Chair, has to appropriate it. So there's complete legislative process has to go through before any money is spent from this Outdoor Heritage Fund and any of the sales tax.
I understand that, but at least insofar as the staffing is concerned, where we have LCMR, whatever we call it these days, and the other kinds of legislative commissions, Mr. Hubinger has had the responsibility to review the budgets of those commissions. In this instance, where that's not the case,
So the operational budget comes through
yes.
the LCC.
So it would be. Yes. So, Mr. Chair, once we make this transfer and hire under the LCC, then he would have that.
Okay. All right. So you will have.
Yet. He doesn't yet.
Okay. But once those determinations are made, you're still going to have the ability to review the staff and expense budget.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Because obviously with our commission budgets, we don't see that in terms of the details of the budget pages. If you look at Senator Betzold's budget pages and division, he can certainly request that, but usually it's just the single line item for whatever the particular commission is, whether it's LCMR or Council on Economic Status Women, whatever it is. We just see the single figure. We don't see the details. But if Mr. Hubinger is going to have that responsibility, so there's at least that kind of check and balance in terms of the expenses of the commission.
And Mr. Chair, remember that we, as legislators, we appointed four legislative members to the commission, to the council as well. I'm a member of it. Senator Ingebrigtsen is a member of it, and then there's two House members. So there's that connection as well. And so we'll have the ability to look and participate in setting that budget.
I'm not sure that's assuring, but that's okay. all right, that's helped me out a little bit. Are there other questions on Senator Anderson's bill? Further discussion? Motions?
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 119 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay, we have Senator Anderson's motion. Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Roebling?
Is the DNR okay with it?
Somebody, good question.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for the discussion on this issue. Going back to Senator Fredrickson's initial comments, the DNR did not ask to be named in statute to provide the administrative support. We were never even consulted with as this moved through the conference committee, so we were just appointed to be the administrative support entity for the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council, which is it's a hybrid, as you're talking about. It's established within the legislature, but it's a quasi-legislative executive mix. And I think one of the things we need to discuss is, as the legislature is moving this into the Legislative Coordinating Commission, we need to make sure that the requirements of the DNR to provide that administrative support are dealt with so that we are not required to do that administrative support, change DNR to the Legislative Coordinating Commission or something like that. After the amendment passed, Commissioner Holston made a commitment to make sure we would do all we could to get the Lasard Heritage Council up and running. With that, we identified a rough budget of about $100,000, identified a funding source within the Game and Fish Fund to provide those costs. We reallocated or reassigned Bill Becker, who is now on, for all practical purposes, administrative leave from the Department of Natural Resources as a temporary executive director of the council. To date, we've expended about $12,000 in salary and fringe and miscellaneous expenses, and we do have right now $2,500 of reimbursements for travel and meals and such that are pending that we're reviewing to make sure they're accurate. Depending on the process that this appropriation goes through, we'll either fund those or transfer those requests to the LCC. But we are paying for the cost of the commission right now, the administrative costs of it, and we have allocated about $100,000 for FY09 to do that. So we're doing all we can to make sure the council is up and running. Mr. Chair, your concerns about the council hates the DNR, they don't get along with a lot of people right now. Everybody who testified or asked somebody to vote for this amendment, I think, has their own idea of what those dollars should be spent for, and that's one of the things the legislature is going to have to wrestle with is the many thousands of different people involved in the successful passage of this amendment have almost just as many ideas on how those dollars should be spent. So it's a good challenge and opportunity for us to have.
And to be fair, I might have overstated that, kind of lapsing into maybe Senator Murphy language for a second there. But certainly I have heard all these discussions of, why we're suspicious of the DNR, and maybe it's just kind of a healthy rivalry of sorts. So my comment might have been a little bit overstated. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I just want to also clarify that I had told the DNR I would like to have the reimbursement for Bill Becker's salary to be part of the DNR budget and not have that be reimbursed by the LCC. So the intention here is just to use the LCC money to pay for expenses where the DNR would have to go out, pay for things external to the agency. So it would pay for members' expenses and for the hiring of the staff. But the Bill Becker, the internal DNR expenses that are related to this council, we'll deal with those in our regular budget decisions and with the Heritage Bill as it goes through. So this money would not be, there wouldn't be a check written from the LCC back to the DNR. That would not be my intention with this bill. Everyone's looking very confused.
A little bit. Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I thought that would be part of the $150,000, but that isn't going to be. The money already expended won't be part of the $150,000.
Well, that's a good question, Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling. I don't know if we know exactly how much, if the $150,000 will cover that $12,000 of Bill Becker's salary. It probably could. I don't know exactly. Like I said, we don't know exactly what our budget is yet.
Been an actual out-of-pocket expense to the DNR, either we take care of that in some fashion, or, Sir Anderson, you're going to have to adjust for that in your budget. And Mr. Watson raises another good point. Are we going to continue to keep that language relative to the DNR in the statute?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that was Bob Meyer's concern, too. We want to make sure that they don't have to keep providing administrative support anymore after we make this transfer. And
okay, well, maybe that should be in this bill, then.
Well, there's going to be, the money will be transferred. I mean, as long as we don't have a gap in time. So once the money is transferred, we still have to make sure we have a new staff person on board before we eliminate the DNR's responsibilities. But I agree that as soon as that happens, it would make sense. So we could have it take effect when there's – but the other thing is we will have a bill, remember, after April 1st, we will have the bill appropriating the sales tax money, and we could certainly do it at that time.
Well, at some point you should have that clarification.
Absolutely.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I think that should occur, taking the Department of Natural Resources as providing staff. I think that should occur in the bill that the Heritage Council will bring before us. And that's what we've done. We've made similar changes in LCCMR, not similar changes, but made changes in LCCMR has been in the LCCMR bill. But when we make the appropriations from the Outdoor Heritage Council to make that change at that point.
Yeah, and my concern is that I think often in the past we have viewed non-general fund funds as not necessarily free money, but obviously we've given less of a look at what we're doing, not just substantively, but in terms of some of these small details. And given the difficulties we have with the budget this year, we might need a little bit of a different mindset relative to all funds. I mean, where we have, this isn't related to this fund, obviously, but where we have the administration folding the healthcare access fund into the general fund, as an example. The utilization of non-general fund funds is something that we haven't paid as close of attention to. And even if it's a $12,000 appropriation for the DNR, given what I assume happens, what's happening within the agencies, every dollar is going to count this year. And Mr. Myers, I don't know, I hope you agree with that.
Mr.
I mean,
Chair,
not relative to the particular issue, but that it's a tough budget year for everybody.
We do fully understand that, and we do appreciate your concern about getting the department reimbursed for these costs. And it's the understanding of the council and Senator Anderson that those costs will be transmitted or recommended through their bill. Just going back to that account discussion, is the Water Rec account within the Natural Resources Fund does have some statutory requirements on it. So I don't know, it'd be good for the record to have fiscal staff just identify the purposes and how the link between the Water Rec Fund and the ability to fund the council. I think we talked to General Fund or the Game and Fish Fund at first. There was some federal aid concerns we had there as well. I'm concerned, as long as the legislature understands those requirements and is comfortable with allowing those resources to be spent for the administration of this council, I guess it's fine with me, or whatever you desire to do. But I just wanted to raise a little bit of concern using Water Rec dollars, and perhaps the cleanest way would be to use some general fund bridge funding to do this in the next three or four months.
That we're not going to do.
Well, Mr. Chair, we were requested by Commissioner Holston to use this account. That's my understanding. So, I mean, the DNR might prefer general fund, but I don't think that's really an option right now.
It is not. I know, Mr. Myers, you've asked for some testimony. Senator Anderson, would that be helpful to the rest of us, or who's volunteering?
Mr. Chairman, Dan Mueller, Fiscal Analyst for the Environment Natural Resources Committee. Originally, this bill came out, the money was coming from the Game and Fish Fund. Then we discovered after talking with the DNR, there were some issues with using Game and Fish Fund. Yes, the easiest way would probably be using general fund, but that's not an option this year. So we had to try
find. No, let me make it clear. That's not an easy way.
No. Well, this year it's not an easy way ever. So we had to find another fund to basically do a short-term, take some money out of that would be repaid. And we had to identify the fund that probably had the least amount of restrictions. At first, in committee, we put in an amendment changing it to the Natural Resources Fund, but didn't specify an account within the fund. So we assumed that the DNR could pick an account to take the money out of short-term until it was paid back. The DNR then specified that they would like us to name an account to have the money come from. There are a number of accounts within the Natural Resources Funds, like trails, parks. Two of the accounts that we thought of were either the non-game wildlife account or the Water Rec account. Money from the Water Rec account does go to fisheries and enforcement and things like that, and I don't know if we'll need I don't think we need a notwithstanding the uses of the account to put money into temporarily to fund, to give to the LCC to help oversee this Heritage Council. If the DNR thinks we need a notwithstanding the purposes of the Water Rec account to put money, to give money to the LCC to temporarily hire someone to oversee the LSARD Council, maybe that's something we'll have to look at. But I don't think we need that, since we already have Water Rec money that is going to areas of the DNR like fisheries.
And remember, Mr. Chair, the purpose of this bill really is to transfer the money, but also to guarantee that it's repaid in 6 months. So it's not, I mean, it is spending from the account, but it's really kind of
borrowing.
Counting. It's a loan, a very short-term loan.
Senator Anderson, this is what you get for having the first session. Senator Rubin, did I see your hand up? Or
no, okay. No, Mr. Chair, I just was saying it was just borrowing. I mean, they're borrowing. It's an interest-free loan. I just wanted to make sure it was coming out of the appropriate account. It sounds like none of them are ideal. This one maybe has a little more resources in than some of the others and would be able to sustain a loan.
All right. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Miller, what's the fund balance in this account?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, at the end of fiscal year 09, there's at least $1.5 million of fund balance, but that's going to be start gradually building back up because the new gas tax money is coming into the account, and I think the DNR actually has a governor's rec to start spending more money out of the water rec account.
Mr. Chairman, just an observation. It's hardly unusual that we've transferred money from one of these accounts to another over the years. I've seen it many times. It's paid back within the biennium.
And I don't disagree with that, Senator Fredrickson. This is an unusual year, though. I'm not sure. Well, of course, it won't. And the way it's structured, it's not going to be paid back within this biennium. So, all right. Further questions for Senator Anderson from the group of us? If not, Senator Anderson moves that Senate file 119 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair and members.
That concludes the committee.